Earlier this year, Telegram raised $1.7 billion, bits with a B, billion, from convertible bonds, money it will use to pay off debt due next year, with $745 million left over. In December 2024, a year ago, the company reportedly earned a profit of $540 million on revenue of $1.4 billion, its first ever profitable year. This year, Telegram's profits are expected to top $700 million on $2 billion in revenue. The social network reportedly has more than a billion active monthly users, including 15 million paid subscribers, a group that doubled over the past year. Last month, in November 2025, the French authorities fully lifted their travel ban on billionaire Pavel Durov, the founder and CEO of Telegram, who was arrested in Paris in August 2024. On charges that he's complicit in the numerous and really pretty awful crimes facilitated through Telegram. In the past 2 years, Durov has granted hours-long interviews to YouTuber Lex Friedman and American journalist Tucker Carlson. Durov also spent 2 days talking to Russian journalist Nikolai Kononov, who recently published a new book that updates what he describes as his 14-year investigation into Pavel Durov's strategy and mindset and the epic of Telegram. The book, titled The Populace, The Untold Story of Pavel Durov and Telegram, is for sale in English, and Kononov agreed to come on this podcast to discuss it. Welcome to the Naked Pravda. Howdy, folks. I'm your host, Kevin Rothrock, the managing editor of Meduza's English Language Edition, and for today's show, I spoke to journalist Nikolai Kononov about his new Pavel Durov book. In The Populist, Kononov describes Durov and other social media tycoons as techno-feudalists, a kind of modern-day lord who analyzes our behavior and sells merchants knowledge about how and when we decide to buy certain things and how whole streams of buyers move. Kononov argues that this is different from the classic corporations of so-called late capitalism. I began our conversation by asking him, what does that mean? When I read about the difference between tech feudalism and late capitalism and so on, I'm often struggling to sort of understand what it means in practice. I mean, to be fair, whenever people use the term late capitalism so much that I have completely lost the track of what it is people are talking about. But when you're talking about Pavel Durov, there are these sort of episodes where you describe his traditionalism. And there's a very vivid moment when he's walking around Berlin. He's confronted by butch lesbians and drug using teenagers and kind of hedonistic. And I don't know, a very modern scene, what you'd expect to encounter in probably a lot of Western metropolises and so on. And he's he is repulsed by this, and we're getting scenes of his sort of traditionalism here. But then so much of his persona, and you write about this in the book as well, is all focused on sort of this techno-modernity, hyper-futurism sort of stuff. And he's a vicious social Darwinist. And so in this sense, it seems less traditionalist to me. And it's more about anything goes if it comes out on top in a brutal competition. So my question, I guess, is do you see the traditionalism and techno-modernity coming together for Durov in some coherent way, or is this just two conflicting aspects to his personality?
I think that there is a conflict between two parts of his identity. First is the product owner and the founder of Telegram, and founder of a product which should be pro. That should be should go ahead of its competitors. So this is the first thing. And here we must say that Pavel Durov was a kind of huge fan of Steve Jobs, and he copied him in many his everyday managerial practices. And Jobs influenced on Durov's business behavior, entrepreneurial behavior. He is very rude and sharp with his rivals and with his partners who are not behaving like he wants as well. So this is the first part of his identity. He wants to be a progressive product owner in tech.
Okay.
And he has a genius elder brother, Nikolai, as well, who invented encrypted original protocol for data transition in Telegram. So that's the one point.
Is Pavel, would you describe Pavel as any form of genius as well, or is it really just Nikolai, his brother?
I think that Pavel is not a technical genius. He's a he's marketing genius, I would say.
Okay. Marketing. Which is ironic because it's at one point in the book, you talk about how he rejects the premise of advertising, but he's a marketing genius.
Yeah, absolutely. He he believes that the product should advertise itself.
Right.
This is his greatest belief. So the second point is that he is very right. I mean, politically, he is very right. He is conservative, and he don't want to hide it. I mean, to hide his views. I think that the reason is that he understood that the audience of center-right, right, alt-right persons in the world is very huge, and it's absolutely okay to, to make photo shooting on a white horse topless.
Yeah, these like super masculine sort of performances.
To produce all these masculine stereotypes, it's absolutely funny, weird, but I think it's a marketing strategy. And at the same time, I can't say that it's kind of mask. It's not a mask. I think it's his true belief. I mean, that he really thinks that, for example, women are not built for coding. They are built for establishing partner relations, market relations, maybe PR, GR, but not product making. And at the same time, he believes that wokeism is an absolute evil, and the leftist thought is absolutely evil too. So, for example, he was very angry with the France's slight turn to be more social state as it is now. I think that as a person who rose in late Soviet years, he had a trauma of a boy who grew up in poverty, a boy who was underestimated, and a boy who was also a contrarian, even in his school. This was school for talented children. It was not an ordinary school, but he felt there underestimated a bit too. So I think that these two parts of his identity don't conflict with each other, because take a look at tech bros, take a look at Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, and others. You can find not the same thing, but the similar one.
Do you think there's anything that makes him stand apart? I mean, obviously you can like find differences in the product that he's selling, the differences between Telegram and say like anything of Tesla and Amazon, et cetera. But like in their personalities and their personal histories, you know, you've written so much about Durov, but you're aware of all these other guys.
This is the main point of my book. I wanted to make a clear distinction between Durov and Thiel and others. So it may sound strange, but Durov seems to be more pragmatical than others. For example, he never invested his money in any political campaign, in any politician. He never associated himself with any political force in any country. He tried to stay away from the traditional politics. And he promoted the freedom of speech as his absolute religion. And this thing makes him attractive for very different audiences, for the different audience around the world in different countries. And this could be drug dealers And that could be also persons who made an uprising in Myanmar, for example. So the protest, which is very well packed into product, sells also very well. And Durov understood it, I think, like 15 years ago when he founded and then headed VK.com,
right,
a prominent Russian social network with the 140 million users. So I think that his strategical bid is to be the king of freedom of speech, which could be understood as a freedom to do literally anything, to say literally anything.
And you're saying that he implements this in a more honest way than, say, Elon Musk, who also claims to be a free speech absolutist, but there's all kinds of examples of him like promoting his own versions of things.
Yeah. But at the same time, we should consider that Pavel Durov performs a totally one-man show in Telegram. That means that all his marketing moves or PR and even GR is made in Telegram by him personally. He really doesn't believe anybody in these important areas, and he makes decisions by himself. He has no counsel or something like this. He can just request an advice from his brother or from other top managers in some tactical things. But strategically, in everything which concerns Telegram, he doesn't want to hear anybody's voice except himself.
Folks, pardon the interruption, but I just wanted to remind listeners that I write a daily newsletter for Medusa. Subscribe and get a brief summary of the day's Russia-related news stories. And also with each message, I look at something interesting in this corner of the world, whether it's a recent research paper, an investigative report, an interview, who knows? I play fast and loose with my selection criteria, so subscribe and find out what tomorrow's edition will bring. Visit Medusa's homepage and sign up. You're talking about how he plays this role as an impartial arbiter, maybe better than some others that claim to do the same thing. But you've also been talking about how he has these like very strong beliefs that are right-leaning. He's like a, you know, rabid social Darwinist. Do you think that those views, do they manifest in some way at Telegram beyond the sort of managerial structure? And you talk about like the hiring practices and how, I mean, you could see a clear reverberation of he hates DEI hiring. And as a result, we don't see any women at all on the development team at Telegram. It's literally all men. He defends it as well. I blind hired them or whatever, and it turns out they were all men. But the fact that he doesn't value diversity is reflected very obviously in the hiring practices. Is there something else about Telegram that you think is shaped by his views, or does he manage to keep them separate?
I think that many, even product features, are shaped by him. For example, the style of the big pictures, the corporate style, with these emoji-like personages. It's a creature of Durov's mind at first. And Durov likes to act as a product manager because he likes to build the product. At the same time, he has to compromise. I mean, that when communicating with the states like European states or Russia or, I don't know, India, he is also compromising with the officials. It could be just some small compromises, but also it could be something like a huge amount of requests which he took from France and then deleted practically all of these accounts. That means that he tactically is ready for compromising. But strategically, Durov understands that he can compromise with the states or with intelligence or everything. But if he will betray his users, his core principles, his integrity in the question of freedom of speech, then at that very moment, he himself would be betrayed by the users, by the investors and tech bros and anybody. So he's in an interesting position because he created a messenger which acts like a social network in which you can do literally anything. Maybe it's a bit unclear for the audience in Western Hemisphere, but there are a lot of persons in the Eastern Hemisphere which really live in Telegram. Food delivery, paying bills, buying tickets somewhere, and so on. All these actions could be performed in Telegram, and they are these things are happening in Telegram every day. You can read news channels, you can watch videos, you can even watch movies without downloading them to your device, which is very important, for example, in Europe. So Durov is a kind of king of this small galaxy. Not small. I said small, but it's more than 1 billion users. And I think that his business vision, business strategy matches with his political strategy.
One of the most important sections in Kononov's book, and I confess, it's a section that was particularly hard for me to understand with my poor grasp of the crypto world. The section is about Telegram's development of a cryptocurrency in 2018 and how the company raised $1.7 billion in investment before the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission shut it down, arguing that the token sale violated federal securities laws. In 2020, Telegram agreed to halt development of the cryptocurrency. In reality, the company transferred the project to a group that's not legally connected to Pavel Durov, but is, in practice, managed and controlled somehow by Durov's allies, as Kononov puts it in the book. For ordinary Telegram users, the system today is built entirely around Telegram's own internal digital currency, which is called Stars. And that's not a cryptocurrency. Users buy Stars through Apple or Google's in-app payment systems and spend them inside Telegram, basically like App Store credits, without ever interacting with wallets, tokens, or blockchains. Now, TonCoin enters the picture only on the back end, where developers and creators can convert the Stars they earn into transferable blockchain token. The separation allows Telegram to satisfy platform rules at the point of purchase with Google and Apple, while settling payouts on its own terms, giving developers a global bank-free payment rail and reducing Apple and Google's long-term control over Telegram's internal economy. At the same time, Telegram avoids the costs and complexities of compliance infrastructure, handling taxes, banking regulations, sanctions screening, and various country-specific restrictions. I had another question about his politics, and you just said not long ago, and also this is part of the book, is that he has avoided playing the global politics game, and this is particularly a major point when you're talking about the Gram cryptocurrency launch or the attempted launch and how the U.S. banking system comes in, U.S. regulators, and they say, you know what, we're not going to let you do it. And he has a moment where he could try to launch it everywhere except the U.S. and go to war essentially with the U.S. financial system, but he decides not to do that because it would, one of the reasons that he decides not to do it, you argue, is that it would make him essentially beholden to countries like Russia and China that would kind of, you know, end up backing him or being the footing for any effort like this. Do you think, has this situation changed at all recently? Has he perhaps like turned against the West? I know that because obviously he's facing these charges in France. I know that he kind of has like publicly sparred with European, you know, censors or European officials making these public allegations about their attempt to get him to censor accounts in Romania in the elections. Seems as though he's sort of cozying up to Russia once more, or at least it looks as though he's perhaps becoming more political, or is that not your reading?
The answer is depends on what you mean by the West. You know, the global West, there is no global West now in 2025. So Durov tried to relocate his team to California. And at the same time, he values New York. He values it very high. And he recently wrote in Telegram that New York City is the one of the smartest, beautiful city in the world, with the great energy, as he told it. But then he faced an encounter with FBI agents. And also he faced the situation when one of his engineers was tempted to leave a backdoor to the intelligence. But when Trump the second time became the president, the wind changed. And I think that now Durov could think more about moving to the US.
Moving in what capacity?
I think that Silicon Valley is the place where a lot of inventors, tech prodigies are situated. And when I asked Durov who are his mates in Dubai, Durov named just a right-wing blogger, a founder of some cryptocurrency pyramid and something like this.
Yeah.
So it's not very interesting for him as for a tech leader to live and to work in Dubai. But at the same time, for sure, Dubai is very suitable, is very nice and suitable place for Telegram in terms of taxation and so on. So I think that Durov is waiting for the situation with tech bros and their alliance with the Trump administration on what this situation could be changed in the recent months. I think it's important. And at the same time, Durov understands that in the US, the Democrats and Republicans can change term or the term cadence over cadence. And he could never guess for how many years the stable situation for Telegram will last. So I think that now he sees Dubai as a safe space, a safe place.
Sure.
And convenient location for taxation, for communicating with his core audience. The core audience is in Asia.
There's a large section of the book devoted to Telegram's work, Durov's work on cryptocurrency. And this is not a field I know a whole lot about, but I thought it was interesting that you're presenting sort of the various sort of sides of this story, in terms of the motivations that Durov has for going into this. I mean, the most obvious one is needing to monetize Telegram and make money and finance the operation. But at various times, we're sort of presented with his like hatred of paying taxes and his like he's constantly seeking out ways that he can pay less taxes, which is natural, I suppose, for a businessman, but he's particularly devoted to it. And also his interest in basically evading existing regulations, whether it's for sort of like media regulations or what he would describe as censorship or banking regulations. And I wonder, when you're doing this research, do you think that is the cryptocurrency project, is he more motivated by the desire to make profits, evade regulations and taxes, or is he like convinced that is it sort of like a more ideological vision, and then he thinks there's like inherent public good in Toncoin or Gram or whatever? Like, do you think he's like a real believer, or is it less altruistic? Is it more just he's a businessman? Because this is a tension that we get in that is, I guess, well known about cryptocurrency, but it's present in the book as well, is that there's some people, even Durov's brother is like this anarchist, as you describe him, and he thinks that by contributing to cryptocurrency, he can somehow fight global poverty or inequality. But the people that they have to find for investors are just like, get rid of the regulations, give me more money. And also, if they're all convinced social Darwinists, then it's hard to reconcile any fight against poverty with like cryptocurrency. And I guess like what I've just said is a sort of messy question. But in your research on all of this, what's the picture of Durov's motivations and his sort of beliefs to you?
I think that his core motivation is to do something outstanding in tech and something with a social impact. But at the same time, he acts like a businessman. And once he told me that if I spend my time on something, then that means that this will bring me some income. And
not just some income, though. The man's a multi-billionaire,
yeah,
right? So A lot of income.
I mean that he's not very fascinated and very interested in becoming a billionaire, but he obviously is interested in building independent, huge financial and tech system. He's interested in the leadership and in influence. I think influence of the minds, not on the only minds of engineers or tech bros, but of the people worldwide. He understood that he is very clever when he was a boy, and this is a kind of nerdish thing that you want to be popular, to have a huge sum of money on your account at the same time, but on the other hand, you want to make some super products, something wow, to perform with the wow effect.
Do you think does he see when he comes up in conflicts with state authorities, for example? Do you think he relishes that conflict? Is it like, does it make him feel heroic? I'm asking you to speculate, obviously. Or is that like a cost of doing business for him? He doesn't like engaging in those fights, but he'll do it.
If you're speaking about the situation with SEC, when the Telegram wanted to make an ICO and to make cryptocurrency Tron official, that was just a pragmatic goal, because without allowance of SEC, all the banks in other countries would be closed for Durov. So if he would go into clash with the US, that means that he would become literally a rebel, literally an outlaw. And I think that he thought about this for a while and decided that no, he wants to live a beautiful, cozy life of a billionaire.
But so definitely some of his, like, his admirers, even his investors, seem to see him this way. Like, you have this anecdote about Pavel Cherkashin, who compares him to Navalny. he even uses the Navalny's, like, motto from his blog, "The final battle between good and neutrality." And like, I remember when I have that highlighted in my copy of the book, because I was taken aback that someone was comparing Durov, you know, fighting regulators, to Navalny, you know, going to prison and dying in prison. But that it seems like that he has a real cult of personality among his allies, I guess.
I think that at that time he was very ambitious, and all the lawyers, all the bankers with whom he worked, convinced him that the ICO will run well. There would be no problems. And only when the SEC sent a letter that a file against Telegram is opened, it was kind of a surprise for Durov. It happened on his birthday, and he received this letter and he was shocked. I think that after this tragic news from SEC was received, Durov thought only for a while and then came to the conclusion that it would be more effective to say okay and to go another way, to establish a kind of tech community and step by step making transition of rights to use this cryptocurrency on the blockchain, which was written by Nikolai Durov. And this is a kind of clever maneuver which allowed Telegram to survive, not to be blocked in US and in some other countries, and to perform as a business entity.
Okay.
I think that it was a moment of choice, and the choice was made kind of against the investors. As far as you remember, he took $1.7 billion, and he told investors that, sorry, but the refund will be done over my rules. So it was interesting. But the thing which is not very funny here is that, as he told Lex Fridman, at that time, on the summer of 2018, he was poisoned.
Right.
I tried to find some evidences, but I failed to do it. But I believe, Pavel, that this could happen because a lot of investors who trusted him, their money, were very angry. And there are a lot of, not a lot of, but a couple of post-criminals among them.
So your speculation is that some of the jilted investors may have poisoned him.
When my colleague Nikita Kondratiev from the Important Stories media outlet investigated that there were some investors in Tone cryptocurrency from the Eastern Ukraine who traded coal mines on Eastern Ukraine mines, I stopped to be skeptical about the version that he could be poisoned by his investors.
The last question I had, at the end of your book, you describe these 2 days you spent, I believe earlier this year, although you correct me if I'm getting the timeline wrong.
It was in November 2024.
Okay, so a little more than a year ago. You spent these 2 days interviewing Durov in Paris, and then you had this pretty long exchange of what I would describe to be deeply philosophical Telegram messages over several months. You point out in the book that Durov has clearly decided recently to be more public, and this seems to be a consequence of that he's making himself more available to journalists and bloggers and so on. Did this access that you got, did it surprise you? I know that you've been writing about him for a long time, but did anything that Durov told you in these exchanges, was it like unexpected? Obviously, you've been tracking his sort of development as a human being for a long time, so you've noticed things change in him, but was there anything actually surprising to you?
I don't think that this exchange was deeply philosophical, but we discussed...
I am the beholder, I have to say, because it seemed quite philosophical to me, but maybe you have a deeper...
Okay, so we discussed a handful of topics about the civil society and its possible control over platforms. So I tried to challenge Durov with the idea that one-man show is not something interesting, something subverting the paradigm of the such a big entity like Telegram. So I asked him why he's so conservative. If he really wanted to change the game, he could make kind of civil council from some activists and some other organizations, NGOs and so on, which can have access to the product decisions which could be made inside the Telegram. So this idea is based on the primitive thought that if the online entity influences the lives of over 1 billion persons, then it's not just a business. It could not be just a business. It's an influence too, or may say weapon. Or may say, I don't know, place where all our emotions or our personal content is posted. So why should one person manage this huge entity, manage the really fate of over 1 billion persons? So I just tried to put this idea on the table and to discuss it. And it wasn't very unexpected what he replied, but it was interesting that his argumentation remained the same as in 2012. He just told me that all these activists and NGOs have a capitalist behind them who gives them money, and I don't want to be influenced by anyone. So yes, it was expected. I mean, such a reply could be expected from Pavel Durov. And I wasn't surprised, but in this point, I finally realized that he is very consistent and at the same time conservative individual.
Thanks for listening, folks. That's this week's show. As always, check out Meduza's homepage for our reporting on Russia, Ukraine, and the surrounding region. Share this podcast with your friends and enemies, if you want. Write a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're tuning in. Until next time.